Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Friday, September 25th, 2009, I am delighted to welcome Andy Beal, founder of Tracker.com and co-author of Radically Transparent. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm thrilled to have a Southern accent on the show. Tell us where it comes from.
It actually comes all the way from southern England, because I'm originally from Brighton in England.
Oh,
and,
okay.
So my accent, although I live in Raleigh, North Carolina, my accent is somewhere over the mid-Atlantic trying to figure out which direction to go in.
Well, as listeners of the show know, my husband's English, so I bring that up quite a bit. So we'll take what we can get. I think it's charming. But, you know, speaking of charming, you are completely the expert when it comes to online reputation management. And as I was mentioning to you before this show started, I think that in terms of practicing whatever it is that you need to do to make sure that you are well-respected and, you know, obviously you yourself present a great brand and are someone that people want to engage with. How do you think that you sort of started this journey? Let's start from the beginning. If you think back to, you know, kind of the concept of, you know, reputation management and online reputation management, where did your journey really begin?
Okay. Well, first of all, it's very kind of you to say the things you did. I'm flattered that that I've, at least in your eyes, gotten that to that position. And I think that you know, if you look back over my career, certainly in the internet marketing space, I started off as an executive of one of the world's largest search engine optimization firms, and we ran keyword ranking and web sourced, and did that for a number of years. And towards the tail end of that, I started getting clients asking me for assistance in a different aspect of Google optimization, and that is they wanted to address negative things that were showing up in Google search results when you type their name into the search box. And that, you know, that started probably in 2004, 2005. I started getting those inquiries, and then kind of, you know, we were the largest company, so, you know, there were competitors and other people taking shots at our brand. So I was kind of put in charge of responding to those and going into forums. And, you know, we had a couple situations where we had an aggressive salesperson that, you know, somebody went into a forum and started talking about. And, you know, I went in there to apologize and let them know that that wasn't our normal practice and that we were investigating it and that I would get back to them with an update. And so really started, you know, the foundation of crisis control. And and then when I started my next startup, we offered that as a service, reputation management services. That led me to consulting in the space, writing Radically Transparent. While I was writing that, obviously I was just buried in research and consulting and just really kind of formulating this, realized there wasn't a lot of information already out there. So, you know, we wanted to put Radically Transparent out there as a guidebook, as a reference point. And then when I got finished with that, obviously, you know, put myself out there speaking, doing interviews, built Tracker, which kind of dovetails nicely with what I'm doing. And, you know, in the last 6 to 12 months, I've pretty much spent all of my time exclusively in the world of reputation management. And it's an exciting space. It's still very much a cottage industry, new space. I think I got in it at the right time and kind of back before anybody was talking about it. And I think I'm kind of at the moment right in the wave of that to some degree.
So I think that I totally agree. I think that it's you know, something that's pretty new, but I find it, you know, when I, you know, having worked at a PR agency before and obviously working in the media, it seems like it's something new. I mean, even if you take the online word out of online reputation management, without there being a crisis around it. Seems like a pretty new concept, but really a logical one. How did you, you know, when you first tried to approach the problem, besides the examples that you gave about forums, did you look into tools that might help you? Where did you, you know, what were some of the first things that you tried to get a handle on it? Because I think that there are people that are at that place right now, probably more people at that place or that feel like they've kind of given up and can't manage their online reputation because they can't kind of figure it out. So maybe explain a little bit of kind of what led to, you know, obviously founding Tracker, which helps with that, and, of course, your book, which is you know, really the guidebook on reputation management. But where did you start? Because I think that kind of helps people figure out where they're at in the process.
Well, I think that, you know, I think I went through a lot of the trial and error that I'm trying to save a lot of other people from having to experience.
Mm-hmm.
As, like you said, there weren't any resources to pull from. Back before I wrote the book, I wrote the Beginner's Guide to Reputation Management, which was like a white paper, 7-8 pages long, and you know, that was 2005-ish, around that time, and you know, there wasn't a lot to pull from, and so, you know, I was piecing together just every little random thing I could, whether it was using Technorati to monitor blogs, Google Alerts to get some email alerts, reading just old school books such as the Clue Train Manifesto and
mm-hmm.
and other books that talked about social media, but not really as we know it today, more along the lines of blogging, etc., and just starting to piece it together. And so Radically Transparent, my book, was a really good exercise in bringing all of those loose ends, those bookmarked items, those books that I've highlighted, and bringing it all together into a central location. And it really helped me to, by writing that book, it really did help me to formalize a lot of the things that I'd been doing up to that point. And so as much as I hope that Radically Transparent becomes a blueprint for other people, it was very useful for me to put that blueprint together because it helped me to add some structure to what I was doing. And so once we published that, you know, I looked around and saw that, wow, you know, if you look at the book, we really are still bringing together different resources that are available. And certainly on the monitoring space, there were some there were and there still are some very expensive solutions that you can use, but there was a big void between Google Alerts and any kind of paid offering. And so that's when I launched Tracker. And unfortunately, by the time I got to Tracker, a speedboat company had taken the correct spelling. So we have TRACKUR.com. But, you know, launched that to be that professional tool, but that was quick to set up, yet more powerful than Google Alerts. So that for $18 a month, someone could kind of get a grip on that. And my heart was there because really the first step for any kind of campaign, and I think if you only do one step, then certainly listening to what's going on the web is going to help mm-hmm. you improve your business, help you improve your reputation. And even if you don't engage, even if you're not ready to set up profiles, just taking the time to listen will pay dividends for your business.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. The point you made earlier about kind of the delving into the research, I think, is a really interesting piece. And, you know, kind of backing up a little bit, you know, what I assume you probably did research into what makes up a reputation, how people either build it or come to it, maybe by birthright. What did you find that was sort of striking to you in your research initially around just the general concept of reputation?
Well, I think that, you know, when we first started the book, and certainly one of the things we cover in the book is that you no longer own your own reputation,
mm-hmm.
especially in the business world. It used to be that a carefully crafted press release or a multi-million dollar TV campaign, it was the precise formula for telling the public who you are, what you represent, and why they should do business with you. And we were really having a one-way monologue with our potential customers. And what's changed is that we are now, it's now a dialogue, And there are other people that have a voice, that have a share in crafting and defining your reputation. And many years ago, that was confined to friends getting together in a coffee shop and talking about their experience with a particular company. But now social media in particular has really allowed that conversation to move online. And I think a lot of businesses are realizing that your reputation is made up of lots of different components, not least of which are the conversations that are happening on the web by your stakeholders, and that is your customers, your investors, your employees, your business partners, and these all contribute to your brand. And you still have, as the brand owner, you still have perhaps the loudest voice, but you can no longer drown out everybody else's.
So I've worked with a company before, or was at the beginning stages in the past. It's a billion-dollar-plus company that's worried about its negative, their perceived negative online reputation. What do you think is the first step when trying to, for those that are practitioners and maybe go out and are following, either use tracker.com or are using the sort of hodgepodge of tools that you've discussed, which I think is pretty common either in marketing and generally in the communication space, to convince clients that, if they need convincing, that it's worth making an effort to either, first of all, monitor and start listening in again, because they've listened in once and they didn't like what they heard, so they just went about the business of what they do, and maybe in the meantime, their reputation's changed. I think I'm asking you this in kind of the reverse order, but I mean, I guess, how do you convince clients that it's worth their time and effort to embark on this, either if they don't perceive it as a problem or they think it's a problem and maybe it's not, or whatever the case scenario is?
Well, I think that, something that I often tell clients is that in the absence of their presence, the void is going to be filled by other people. So are you content to let other people define your brand and to define your business practices? And sticking your head in the sand is certainly not any recommended approach for reputation management or brand building. These conversations are going on with or without you. And so by ignoring them doesn't make them disappear. And I think that, we can point to Dell. It's the classic case study that, has been a little bit overdone now. We all refer to it, mm-hmm. but still just stands firm as a classic example where Jeff Jarvis wrote a pretty scathing blog post about Dell's customer service. The whole Dell hell meme kind of took off. But Dell, if you read through chapter 2 in our book, we case study Dell. Dell's initial reaction was to put its head in the sand, and for about 18 months, they didn't respond. They even went as far as closing down their official forums. And what happened is it didn't go away. Now, what also happened is that, to Dell's credit, they did make some behind-the-scenes changes. They did start making improvements, but those improvements alone were not enough to change the public perception. So ultimately, they had to come out and respond and engage, and they did it really, really well. They launched, first of all, a blog, which turned into a series of blogs. They launched mm-hmm. IdeaStorm, which is a forum that lets customers submit their own ideas for Dell products, and really engaged. They're on Twitter. I mean, even now, to the point where, they can attribute more than $3 million of sales purely to their Twitter channel. I think it is a testimony of how successful it can be to re-engage. So I think that, looking at them is encouragement for any brand. And I tend to work with those type of companies, the companies that had a dark chapter in their history but have turned things around, or perhaps they had a misconception that they really need to address mm-hmm. because it's just not going to go away until they address it, and they turn to me. I tend to avoid those companies that continue to make mistakes or continue not to care about their customers. We have a great quote in the book from Abraham Lincoln about your character is like a tree and your reputation is like its shadow. I mean, so effectively your reputation is only as good as your character, and if you don't change your character, there's very little you can do to change your shadow or your reputation, if you like. And so you've really got to start with your company, start with its ethics, its products, the way it runs itself, and you got to fix those first. Otherwise, all you're going to be doing is applying Band-Aids to your reputation, and it's going to be like a game of whack-a-mole. You're going to repair one issue. You're going to respond to one negative blog, but you've not changed your core of your business, so it's just going to keep reoccurring.
So, couple follow-ups. So, any examples that you have of companies that couldn't come back, or industries that you think maybe that you would. At this point, I think of the banking industry, I guess, that I have in mind, certain banking institutions that, based on recent events, just can't come back, or that should, maybe even rebrand themselves, or other examples where a product maybe doesn't have, or the company doesn't have the best ethics behind it. The examples I can think of there is really in the green space, where there are a lot of companies obviously making green claims. I think as the media starts to delve a little deeper, I think we're already starting to see this. There are very savvy VCs out there that I think are doing a good job of vetting whether that's really true to begin with. But green credentials, I think, once they start to come into question, certainly those of us that work with companies, we know whether we're working with somebody who's trying to put on a dog and pony show or the real thing. Have you ever had that experience where, either you feel like the product isn't sound, or you've heard of examples or case studies where the product isn't sound, so the reputation probably is not going to be that good. Maybe they'll have a good flash of publicity, and that'll help, and they'll build something online, or just a company that just you would recommend they just start over, rebrand under a new name.
Yeah, well, I think there are many instances that cover all of those. I mean, there are many startups that launch to great publicity but end up being very vacuous and just superficial and just fade away because there was never a product that that really supported it. You're going to have situations where companies' reputations get so bad that they rebrand. And so you've got GMAC, the financial institution, that rebranded as Ally Bank, and is trying to reinvent itself as a new bank that's consumer friendly, that believes that things should be done differently. We're seeing General Motors trying to rebrand that, and let people know that, that it stands by its products, and they're doing I believe it's them that's doing a campaign where you can return any car within 60 days for a refund. Yep. So you're seeing things like that, but then you're also going to see a pig is never going to be a swan, right? So
exactly.
If you're a pig of a company, then that could be because you've got a really bad reputation, or that you're really not offering anything of value, and so you've got your issues there. But it could just be that you're never going to turn into a swan, and so accept who you are. And so you've got companies that make products that are harmful to the environment, or you've got cars that the Hummer that only gets 10 miles to the gallon.
Oh, I know.
You can't change that. So you just got to accept that you're always going to face those criticisms. And there are some companies out there that it's like, look, we cannot change the fundamentals of your business, because if you do, you're going to go out of business. So you got two choices. You do change the fundamentals of your business and you completely, destroy your revenue stream. Or you accept that you are what you are and you just kind of take your the hits that you get to your brand. But realize that there are some people that are going to still buy your product because to them it's not a big deal. So then you find your centers of influence, those people that are, fans of your product, and you focus on making sure that they remain happy, making sure that you keep those people happy. So, for example, you're never going to keep them. You're never going to please environmentalists if your Hummer. You're just never going to do it. You can't take 10 miles a gallon and turn it into something that they're going to like, right? You can't dress it up anyway. But, okay, so that's fine, but your core customer base, the people that love the Hummer, they think it's a great car. They're not too worried about the environmental impact. You have to keep them happy. If they turn on you for some reason, you're really in trouble.
That's very, very true. It was weird because I haven't seen a Hummer in a while. I went to visit my family in what we call either the armpit or the Midwest of California, in the Fresno area, and I saw a Hummer for the first time, and it was interesting how you have these guttural reactions, and I think these are the things that make up, obviously, reputation and, you know, ultimately word of mouth. But I saw somebody valet parking a Hummer, and I got really angry. I don't know why. I just, you know, I try to be pretty environmentally sound in my personal life, but I've never really taken a big stake, you know. But it's funny how, you know, you can kind of have that visceral reaction. And that kind of leads me to my next question, which is around companies that these are examples that tend to be kind of early stage, maybe haven't figured out their business model yet, and they have a great brand. I think about how even the press works in other countries. This can contribute to that, you know, being from England, you know, building, you know, elite, you know, personal people that have built personal brands up only to tear them down is something that, you know, does happen. It happens here as well. But, you know, you look at a company like Twitter, you know, people are saying, you know, different, very respected people have said, the guys that founded it should be, you know, nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize because of all the communication that's been able to take place with the situation in Iran. You have others that just love it for, you know, the practical purpose of getting quick feedback. Obviously, companies like Dell, as you pointed out earlier, have made millions using it as a tool. So we know Twitter doesn't even have a business model yet. They're saying there's no ads this year. I think, you know, some people, you know, felt relief over that, like, you know, ads are going to ruin Twitter's reputation. What do companies like that that get into this position of kind of, you know, they're esteemed, but they're, you know, and they are now in the black, but they're probably just, you know, I wouldn't imagine they're making a ton of money. They're still raising money. What can they do to make sure that they don't face backlash later when they say, okay, well, we're going to monetize these pieces, and this is how it affects you, if it
and
does.
That's the core problem for the whole freemium model, because you have a lot of these companies that launched offering a free service with always having the intention that they would later figure out the business model. So they always thought, well, okay, we'll make money somehow. We just don't know how just yet. So we'll make it free. We'll burn through our venture capital money, and hopefully we'll either get acquired or we'll figure out the business model, right? So they do that, and so their user base gets accustomed to the idea that in their minds it should be free and should remain free. And then what happens is when that company starts to try and figure out how to make money, it's a big shock to the system. I think that, you know, where I've seen it done successfully in those instances is, you know, always providing a free alternative that's similar to what your user base was accustomed to. And so you can maybe offer new features that you know are in high demand, but only offer those to the premium level. So, for example, I'm a big fan of Flickr. And for many years I used Flickr's free service. But, over the last few years, I've really gotten into photography more, and so now I use their premium service, and I pay. It's only $25 a year, but I pay, and I get extra features because of that are valuable to me. And so if I wanted to revert back to the free version, I absolutely could. And so I think that is something that these companies have to keep in mind. And honestly, part of the reason why when I launched Tracker, we started off with a fee for every single service because, you know, I'm in this to make money. I want to provide a great product that people like, but at the same time, you know, I need to put, you know, food on my table. So, I've not really faced that situation, but I can see it coming down the road with Twitter. I mean, it's really become, intrinsic to the way we communicate, and people, especially early adopters, you'll always find that they're very vocal against any kind of major change, and you see it whenever Twitter makes any kind of tweak whatsoever to the interface or, you know, anything of that nature. people are going to complain. And their next challenge is not actually going to be monetization of their site. It's going to be when they add this retweet button that's coming down the road in terms of their interface. They're going to integrate retweeting. But there are going to be some people that don't, you know, that won't like the path that Twitter has chosen on that, and you're going to see some rebellion. And I think we can look at Facebook and look at how Facebook's made changes that they had to go back on because they went too far. And so I think that, you know, part of reputation management is to listen to your core audience and to poll them and to get them to buy in to the decision making. Don't give them free rein because they don't know your business. But at the same time, there's an opportunity for you to at least give them a chance to be heard. And I think companies that do that tend to find things smoother when they kind of make the launch.
Yeah, I think that makes complete sense. I think one of the questions, you know, obviously, you know, as we turn to, you know, looking at tracker.com. As you noted, it's TRACKUR.com. You have a free tier of your service, which I've signed up for, and, you know, to be able to take a look. And, you know, I think it's a very, you know, obviously it's interesting, it's different, but in terms of where it's at in the space, do you feel like sometimes in building a reputation, if something is, how do you sort of build, I guess my question would be, I feel like Tracker doesn't really have competition, really, you know, I mean, in terms of, you know, you're talking about Google Alerts and kind of piecing all these free tools together, there's nothing that really does what Tracker, you know, the complexities of, and the nuances of all the mentions and the different things that it pulls together to help you assess your path. So maybe explain to us what Tracker aims to do, what it does, and kind of how it works, and I'll follow up with a few more questions along the lines of building the reputation for that product and what you're doing to do that.
Okay. So, Tracker is designed to be a simple dashboard for keeping an eye on any type of media that mentions your brand. So you know, if you can use Gmail or Google Reader or something like that, you can use Tracker. You type in the name of your company, your executive, you click search, and we scour the web and we bring back all kinds of different results, mainstream media, blogs, tweets, images, video, in a single dashboard. We allow you to kind of look through to see what's being said. You can click through to the actual source of the article. You can view its influence. You can tag it, favorite it, send it to a colleague or coworker. And then you can also subscribe to the updates. If you don't want to check in with the dashboard each day, you can get updates by RSS or email alert. And so we kind of keep it all in a central place. And it's, you know, we say it takes less than 60 seconds to set up. And so that's, you know, that's what we're offering here. And we are unique in a way. There are other social media monitoring tools out there, but they either cost a lot more than we do, or they have a lot more features that kind of clutter everything up. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I use something like Google Analytics, there are probably over 100 different features that Google Analytics offers, but I only ever really focus on four or five that are really meaningful. Mm-hmm. And so what we've done with Tracker is concentrate on the meaningful, got rid of all of the eye candy that looks good the first time you look at it, but then you find that you never really use it, so why pay for it? And so that's what we've done with Tracker.
So how do you build a reputation for something that's new in a space? So using Tracker as an example, where there is, you know, I acknowledge, you know, as you do, that there are other similar products that are either more costly or free, which means, and a lot of times with free products, you know, I always note that a lot of the problem in the pudding there is that they're not configured properly because you right. don't have support, et cetera, that's available to you easily, or you're not paying for that. So it's not offered to you. So how do you do that? How do you, you know, decide on a business? It's brand new in a space. Does it have to have a reputation? I mean, is it more about just recognizing a problem and serving it?
Well, I think that, you know, we do have to have a positive reputation, and certainly, being fortunate enough to have built my own personal brand and to have the book out, I'm able to extend my own reputation to Tracker, which kind of gives us a fast track to building its Tracker's own reputation. But we have to, you know, we have to get our message across that it's simple yet sophisticated, easy to set up. We have to, you know, help spread the word, ask other people to conduct reviews. When we first launched, I brought in industry experts to kind of take a look, and they wrote reviews of Tracker, which kind of helped spread the word because, you know, they were all positive. And so there's a lot of things that we did at launch. There's a lot of things that I continue to do. And I'm eating my own dog food. I'm using social media, blog posts, Twitter. We're running a Twitter contest right now, so we're engaging people on Twitter with a contest to win prizes if they engage with our Twitter account for Tracker. And there's a lot of things that we're doing, and so yeah, we do have to build it. But there's an awareness issue we have as well, because we are in a space that's so new that we have to educate people as to why they even need this. So it's not enough to focus on the features of Tracker. We need to focus on the benefits of Tracker and let people know that, look, you probably, you know, you're probably only just starting to be aware that you have this need, that you, you know, you can't keep track of everything that's said about you online. You have outgrown Google Alerts, and what's the next step? And so we kind of, you know, present Tracker as a solution to that. And so it's ongoing. I mean, you know, we continue to, we have great retention rates. Those people that do sign up for Tracker tend to stay with Tracker, and, you know, we have very few people that ever leave. Most people just upgrade to the next level of service, and hopefully that trend will continue. And I'm very mindful of the fact that, you know, when I attached my own brand to Tracker, that you know, I owe people, I have a responsibility to make sure Tracker is a good product that doesn't let them down, and that if it does, it's going to reflect badly on me. So I take that as a very serious commitment to ensure that Tracker continues to grow and to be of value.
So you mentioned attaching your personal brand to it, you know, and mm-hmm. I think that's a really great point, because obviously we all want to protect, you know, the integrity of what we've, you know, if we've been in a particular industry, especially for a long time, or put our heart and soul into it, even for a year, you want to make sure that you get out of that, you know, hopefully something that people recognize of value. And one of the things that, you know, I had said to you before we started the show was, you know, you have an amazing reputation online in that of all the people that I've interviewed, you know, that are, you know, in your caliber, you know, that have, you know, either written a book or, you know, launched companies, very high-level folks, I've had the most positive sentiment towards you of anyone, and I don't mean to embarrass you. I know you're English, so you know that get embarrassed easily. But but you know, what do you attribute that to? Because I think that if you know if any other CEO could aspire to have the kind of respect that people seem to bring to your name, they could sell a lot of whatever it is that they're trying to sell.
Yeah, well, you know, there is a simple answer to this, but it's not necessarily something that a lot of people could mimic. You know, and I'm going to deviate completely from anything that you would read in a book or anything that I've written, and that would I would say that my faith and my Christian beliefs are the foundation for how I conduct myself. And even if you take that to one side and just kind of dissect it purely on a character basis, I try to live my life authentically. It's mm-hmm. something that my wife even reminds me of, is to live authentically. And that is, I want to just do right by people. I want to present myself, honestly. I don't ever want to be caught out in a lie. I don't ever want to treat anybody any differently than the way I'd want to be treated. And, you know, you talk about having a reputation that people are watching you and critiquing you, then the fact that, you know, that I earnestly believe that God is watching over me in every action that I do, and he is judging my reputation, That's a very compelling, very compelling to kind of make sure that you kind of conduct yourself with integrity. And so, in addition to that, you can also look at the fact that, look, when you're in this space and you are the person that's talking about online reputations, you better make sure that you're just squeaky clean. So I try to, keep that in mind that, you know, I need to keep mine, you know, clean. And I just try to treat people the way that I hope that they want to be treated. I try to be friendly. I try not ever to go on the attack. Even when I'm writing something scathing on Marketing Pilgrim, I try not to focus it at individuals. I try to kind of steer towards company brands because, you know, there's not a person behind that. And so, I don't know, I've just tried to kind of, take that into account over the course of my career. And I've been blessed that I have a lot of good friends that are online that I really enjoy interacting with. I think a lot of people seem to aspire to the same goals that I have of how I treat people, and maybe I'm just surrounding myself with good friends, and they just happen to be the people that you spoke to that had nice things to say about me, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's definitely, you know, it's a fabulous thing, and I think it's actually, in a sense, and, you know, obviously, I'm really not trying to overstate this. I really think that in terms of faith, I think it's something people they're scared to talk about, you know, and maybe it's a little different where, you know, in the Carolinas where you're based, but I feel mm-hmm. like on the West Coast, you'd never hear, a particular, mm-hmm. you know, person with a huge, you know, brand reputation. People are scared to talk about faith or mm-hmm. anything that could be perceived as, you know, could be taken the wrong way or doesn't
right.
feel inclusive. You think it's you know, being really truthful to the point of this is just who I am that is part of, you know, building a personal brand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, I don't judge anybody. It's, you know, I'm in no position to judge anybody. My faith is all-encompassing. It's, you know, I don't exclude anybody. Everybody, you know, as a Christian, we, you know, it's open arms to everybody. But I do agree with you that, you know, there are a lot of people that are afraid that they'll either maybe appear weak or perhaps they will suffer some kind of attack because of their faith. And I see that a lot. But, you know, honestly, I have a greater fear of not being upfront and honest about my faith. I mean, I don't ever want to reject my faith. So that there's nothing that, you know, someone could go on an attack against me because of that, and that would be nothing compared to me publicly rejecting my faith. And so, you know, to be honest with you, I'm more fearful of admitting to being a Republican online than I am to being a Christian.
Mm. I think I would agree with you. Yeah, I mean, but
because
you know,
I would come under attack more for that probably than anything else. I mean, it's very politically charged online these days, and so
mm-hmm.
you know, that's kind of, I say that in jest, but I mean, you know,
no, it's absolutely the truth.
Yeah,
I mean,
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say I had an example that I've said on other podcasts before where. We had an intern at my last company who was asked to engage on Twitter during the last election, and you know, we weren't thinking about that. The idea was to give him an exercise that would be useful to him, and so he looked at the other tweets, sort of trending topics, what was, you know, what people were talking about, and this was, you know, someone who was kind of a doe, you know, in the woods. You know, not really aware of, you know, how much what you say can kind of matter if you're doing it for a company or even experimenting for a company, and immediately revealed his political views, obviously working for a PR company that doesn't always work if you're not, say, the principal of the company, or if the principal
right.
has, you know, directly conflicting views.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I encountered that immediately. So we sort of had this, you know, little discussion about, you know, kind of keeping it dinner level conversation when it comes to at least the corporate account, right? So that,
mm-hmm.
you know, nobody feels offended. But at the same time, I feel like very few people that have, you know, reputations that are strong enough to be able to come out and say, you know, hey, this is how I live my life. This is what I believe. Mm-hmm. They don't do that. You know, they, mm-hmm. it just feels like it's not done. But so I think that's, you know, I just, you know, as a statement, I feel like that's a really cool thing that you do, because I think there's a huge, huge audience for that. And, you know, having gone to Blog World last year, and the conference that was alongside it was, you know, bloggers that are, you know, that are Christian. And mm-hmm. I spent some time over in that booth, and it was just amazing. And you know, anyway, it was a nice personal aside for me to be able to go over to the booth and chat with people, and you know, got my brother involved in blogging, and you know, became a huge area of interest for him. Got, you know, and I got him involved from a faith perspective. So I think that, you know, that's an area that, you know, is kind of untouched. BeliefNet's kind of gone there a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, anyway, that's kind of a side point. But I...
Yeah, and you know, and it maybe it's to some people it might be a revelation, but if you follow me on Twitter, you'll see that there's no difference between who I am in the business world and who I am as a Christian. I mean, it's just me. And so, what you see is what you get. You're going to get, there's no instance where I put on a hat where I'm a Christian. It is just Andy Beal. This is me. These are my attributes. Here's my failings, my weaknesses. This is what I do. This is who I am. And if you want to follow me on Twitter or you want to read my blog posts, you're going to get all of me. I'm not going to sanitize it. I'm not going to scrub out anything for your benefit. You take me as I am. And I read an interesting book a few years ago called There's No Such Thing as Business Ethics. Because it's all ethics. There is no difference between your ethics in business and your ethics in life. There should just be one standard that you live your life by. And so when you see me online, you're going to see all aspects of me. And, hopefully, you know, if part of that kind of, you know, lets somebody ask a question about their faith and where they are, then that's great too. But it's, you know, it's neither my goal to say things to, get people thinking about their faith, but then again, you know, but it's all, you know, not something that I ignore either. It's just, you know, it's kind of hard to explain. It's just me online. You're going to get this. One of the things that I hope people find is when they interact with me online, it's no different than when they interact with me in person. There's no persona that I put on. So everything I talk about online and the way I interact is who I am in person. And perhaps maybe tying this back into your original question, maybe that's one of the attributes that, you know, maybe my friends and people that I've come to meet and regard as friends, perhaps they like that, is that, you know, I don't play roles or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love people who are willing to sort of put it out there and just speak from their heart almost,
mm-hmm.
But just, you know, be who they are.
Yeah, and I respect those people that are like that, even if I don't agree with them. There are some people that I follow
exactly.
on Twitter that are completely different to me personality-wise, completely the opposite end of the spectrum, but they are being authentic in who they are, and I respect them for that. And so I'm not saying that everybody should be sanitized, clean cut, because I'm certainly not, but I think that there are people, you know, being authentic is a key to success. So don't try and mask your personality. Don't try and mask who you are. If you're a rough cut person that's an atheist that likes to cuss, that, you know, is very in people's faces, and you're like that wherever you are, I have respect for you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're a although, you know, some of the sectors, you know, it depends on, you know, I just think, you know, that's part of the whole idea of community building, right, is that there's others like you out there. So, you know, hiding behind a persona probably in the long run isn't the best way to go, either from a personal or a business perspective, because you're not going to find that fulfilling part, at least for me, of social media, where you find that human connection, you know. And,
right.
And I think that's where, you know, kind of getting back to the business aspect of it, of brand building and some of the examples that you've brought up, I wanted to ask you one question is that, you know, you're definitely known around the world because I've gotten pinged from people around the world. And I think you've worked, if I remember correctly from what I've read, you've worked internationally. Can you tell us about anything you found internationally that's been particularly insightful around reputation management, online or offline?
I think that there are, you know, certainly you've got to take into account different customs with different different nations. I mean, there are some, you already alluded to the fact that, you know, English people tend to be a little bit more reserved, a little bit more stiff upper lip, let's kind of hide our emotions kind of thing. And, you know, I think that, you know, certainly, you know, that's a classic example of, perhaps an overly flamboyant, loudmouth CEO in England is, not necessarily the norm that you would find there, and so that brings about maybe reputation issues. But then you've got examples like Richard Branson, who is the most flamboyant CEO that you could perhaps find, and you know he thrives there because he is different.
My English in-laws don't like him for that. So I think it's, you know, you come across some of it's, you know, it all crosses lines, but you know some of it's generational too.
Yeah, and then you've also, you know, it takes us back to who's your target audience. People that love the Virgin brand love Richard Branson, and they love it when he dresses up, whether he's dressing up in a bride's outfit or whether he's, you know, pulling some kind of stunt by ballooning in from somewhere or whatever it is. He is appealing to his target audience, his centers of influence, his stakeholders. So I think that, you know, you shouldn't try and please everybody, because not everybody is a stakeholder in your brand. So you don't expect that everybody in the world is going to like you. There are plenty of people that probably don't like what I'm doing with Tracker, don't care for me as a blogger or a business owner, but that's fine because they're not who I'm trying to reach, and I accept that I can't appeal to everybody. So I think maybe that's a critical thing to be aware of, is that your brand is not going to appeal to everybody, but it should appeal to your stakeholders. Those people that do have a vested interest in your brand are the ones that you certainly need to focus on.
So one question that follow up on that. So we're in the last 15 minutes here, but I really want to follow up on that because I have a really great example. My in-laws are always a great example. As I said, they're English. They always fly Virgin to see us here in the Bay Area. And they are absolute Virgin customers. They're probably not the target, but they always fly business or first class, so they're spending they spend an exorbitant amount of money to fly Virgin.
Mm-hmm.
They use additional services in the airport at a cost.
Mm-hmm.
They absolutely are money makers. Yet when it would have been so easy for them to fix from a customer service point of view. My mother-in-law can only eat certain foods, so she requested a vegetarian meal from SFO back to Heathrow, and there wasn't one for her. So she had to starve in first class all the way from a direct flight from SFO to Heathrow, which, you know, is a long time to not eat, especially if you have dietary issues. Long story short, they went through almost a year of customer service issues only to get some vouchers that they've not really been able to use. Really, really, so, you know, knowing all of the intricacies of it and going, my God, this is a great case study of these people don't fall within the hip demographic, but they fall within they've got a kid living abroad, they're going to fly consistently every year, they say, you can follow their pattern pretty easily. They're online all the time, they're very, very connected.
Mm-hmm.
Are there people, so that brings up to me the point of the overall, the companies that maybe define their brand too narrowly and are excluding a segment that would be more apt. So now they would rather fly BA than they would Virgin.
Mm-hmm.
But
they
tend to stick with Virgin because they like the services that they provide. I mean, have they really missed the boat by not being more thoughtful in their approach to even their customer service with in this particular case or in cases
well,
like it?
Well, it's obviously we're kind of speculating on the reason for the, you know, the poor service. So let me kind of twist it just ever so slightly and just kind of use this as a case study of perhaps the biggest thing that a business can do is to make sure that they have systems in place to address the concerns and complaints of their customers adequately. Here, this took far too long for any kind of resolution, and it was a poor resolution. If you look at time and time again, if you look at those people that write scathing blog posts, tweets or videos or images, they are people that initially tried the official channel to get some kind of compensation or get something rectified, and that channel failed. So they then, basically the attitude is then, okay, well, I'll show you, I'm going to make your life hell. And they go on this rampage. Think about that. Think about, you know, using the airlines. I mean, think about the guy that wrote those, sang those music videos, United Breaks Guitars. He tried to get satisfaction through the official channels, and they failed him. Think about people that go on TripAdvisor and post negative reviews. If only they were told that if you had any problems with the room, we will rectify it no matter what, they wouldn't be on TripAdvisor talking about the fact that there were cockroaches in the room and that nobody seemed to care at the front desk. So I think that as businesses, if you want to cut down on your chances of being attacked, fix your customer service to the point that you not only make it easy for someone to complain, but you identify the lifetime value of that customer. In this case, someone that flies, you know, upper class a lot with Virgin and on a regular basis, and then can take into consideration what, not what is it going to cost us here in terms of compensation, but if we don't do this, what will it cost us? So in this instance, they should have gone beyond the, here, we'll give you a few vouchers for, you know, dollars or something like that, but maybe looked at this and said, well, these, you know, we could potentially lose their business. What is that worth over the next 10, 15 years? And what if they go online and start posting about this? What is that worth in terms of other customers deciding not to fly us because of that bad experience? And I think a lot of businesses fail to do that. So it may be that they said, you know, they looked at the profile and decided, you know, that they weren't a target audience. But I think that probably more than likely is that the system fell down. And maybe as part of that system, they had the wrong criteria in there as to who they treat well and who they don't. But I think, you know, a lot of businesses need to look at their customer service and how they treat customers. The simple apology, honestly, I mean, saying that you're sorry does not make you liable to anything. Even if you said, I'm sorry that your experience did not meet your expectations, let's see what we can do to rectify this. You're not admitting anything. You're not, you know, I think a lot of people are too concerned that their attorney tells them never admit anything, never apologize for anything, and they get into these problems. So I think focusing on that, you know, maybe listening to what's being said online and then fixing your customer service are the two biggest things that companies can do. It's not scary. It's not, you don't have to set up a Facebook profile or start blogging. Just listen and then fix your customer service, and you're going to find a lot of your reputation problems go away.
Really good advice. So here's hopefully a quick question for you. You speak all over. What's the number one question you get asked?
Aside from where's my accent from?
Yeah, aside from where your accent's from, we've covered that already.
Okay, the number one question I get asked, I think, you know, typically it is, you know, what is the first step? What should I do first? And I think that, you know, we have touched on that as well. And I think listening is key. If you think about how businesses in the, you know, 80s and 90s and the early part of this decade, how much money they spend paying market research firms to go out and find out what people like about their products and their competitors' products. I mean, you know, the average company might spend, you know, a mid-sized company might spend $100,000 just on market research. We now have these tools available that allow us to listen for free or for very low cost and collect that feedback. And if you've got big companies out there that are doing it, you know, Dell's doing it, you've got airlines that are starting to do it. If these people are listening, then I think that any company should kind of be listening to what's being said about their products and taking that feedback. And so normally that's the question, because I think a lot of people think that the first step is to start a blog or to get on Twitter or to do this or do that. And really, you know, I think one of the first tactics is to listen. Perhaps one of the you know, even before that, you could say, just sit down and look at what are your weaknesses. You know, honestly, just an honest evaluation of what do you need to improve. And I think that, you know, that's something that that would be worthwhile as well.
Any mistakes that you feel like you've made along the way?
Yeah. I mean, I've personally made mistakes. I've fallen into that trap of, writing something that is purely on the basis of I want to get page views or increase my RSS count or something like that, and I'll write something that I don't feel good about and wish I hadn't written. And I try to do less of that.
So what did you do after that happened? Did you act on it, was it something kind of you're looking back later going, maybe you shouldn't have done that?
This is pre-reputation management days, back when I was blogging in the early 2000s, really. I'm not saying I haven't made any mistakes since, but, for this particular instant, I don't know. I think that, one of the hardest things that I have found, and perhaps this is a lesson, I preach all the time that you should listen to your customers and you should take on board even the negative things. But I realize now by having Tracker, I realize it is hard to do. It is hard to hear negative things about your business. It is hard to hear that there are certain features that people would like to see added. It is hard to hear that people don't want to use PayPal to sign up, and so they're not going to use the service. You've got to open yourself up to that, because if you're not aware of it, if you don't take the time to listen, you'll never learn. And even if you're not in a position to change it or you don't want to change it, you should at least be aware of it, because you know that then that's something that is going to be an issue. And so I think, as hard as it is for all of us to take any, to hear anything negative, I think that, it's good therapy for us to listen to, to open ourselves up. So even if it's just something like sending out an email asking your customers, what do you think of us? If you're really cringing about the response, then maybe you've got bigger issues.
Yeah, absolutely. So beyond the examples that you've given of particular, maybe clients or others that you've worked with, are you still working with clients on an individual basis?
I work with a couple right now. I've been fortunate enough that I've been able to kind of back out of consulting work and focus on Tracker and a few other projects that I'm working on. But I still work, I still work with, usually
have
a couple
decide...
of clients.
I'm sorry, we're almost out of time, so I just wanted to get in the follow-up, which is how do you choose who to work with if you only have enough time to work with so many?
Okay, so that's a great question. So I focus on those customers that have made a change to their system or process. So whatever the negative thing was, they're putting it behind them. They have an honest desire to engage and shift things and to try and make their reputation better. I stay away from those customers that just want me to do a cover up. I'm not the guy that comes in, if you commit a murder, I'm not the guy that's going to come in and get rid of all the evidence. So I'm not a cover up guy. I want to work with brands that made a mistake. It was an honest mistake. They've made a change, but they need my help to kind of help change that perception, and want to do it, commit to it on a long-term basis so that I can really get in there and help them over the course of a few months or a year.
Well, on that note, I will let you get on with your day. I thank you so much for being our featured guest today. Again, Andy Beal has been our guest, founder of Tracker.com and co-author of Radically Transparent, a book that you should definitely pick up if this is at all interesting to you, and encourage you to continue the conversation with him online. He's got a great Twitter following. Thank you so much, Andy.
Thank you, Jennifer. I really enjoyed the show, and good luck with future shows.
Thank you. You've been a pleasure to speak with, and I want to thank – thanks. And I want to thank those of you that have tuned in to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay, and, of course, Andy Beal today. We hope you enjoyed the program. If so, we'd love it if you'd be so kind as to friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to tune in next week when my featured guest is Richard Binhammer, a.k.a. Richard at Dell. That's 1 week from today at 12 noon Pacific. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show, archives, and free informational webcasts at jenniferlindsay.com. Have a great weekend, everyone.